from WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at SUNY Geneseo this past semester when a professor made a significant change to how he grades students. The professor is Michael Oberg, a distinguished professor of history with not only many years' experience, but a stack of books and publications under his belt, and yet Oberg found himself questioning the very process of assigning grades. He had been influenced by conversations and articles from colleagues, some at SUNY Geneseo, some at other institutions. And so this past semester, as he describes in a new blog post, he undertook an experiment in what is commonly known as ungrading. Ungrading can refer to a collaborative process between professor or teacher and student to come to a conclusion about the student's grade. And it can vary. Some colleges and universities require letter grades for students, after all, so the idea of no grades at all is not always possible. But ungrading is, at minimum, a dramatically different way of grading. And here's what Oberg did. He writes, quote, "I stopped scoring papers, opting instead to write lengthy comments, and I met with each student. I teach about 90 to 100 students a semester during finals week for individual conferences. They handed in their final papers, and they told me what they thought they deserved for the course. I wanted to encourage student input into the grading process," end quote. Oberg found that students tended to be honest about how they viewed their own work, with some students underestimating their own performance. He's encouraged to refine his approach, and he draws on the work of other educators, like Kate Denial, Knox, and Jesse Stommel, who have written about ungrading. In a piece titled, "Why I Don't Grade," Professor Stommel writes, quote, "I am even more certain of what I instinctively knew when I first taught a class in 2001. Grades are the biggest and most insidious obstacle to education," end quote. But there are critics of ungrading. Generally speaking, they believe that there should be a power dynamic between professors and students. They're not meant to be equals, the critics say, and the students should understand their place in the classroom. They should be held to rigorous standards. They should be taught that failure is part of life. Well, this hour, a conversation about grading, ungrading, and the most effective ways to teach. And our guests include Professor Michael Oberg, Distinguished Professor of History at SUNY Geneseo. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And on the line with us is Kate Denial, who's a professor of American history and chair of the Department of History at Knox College in Illinois. Welcome, Kate. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks.
I got to say, Michael, I reached out to you and your first reaction was to say, look, I'm sort of following a trail being blazed by others here. I'm not the full authority. And I thought you were very gracious in doing that. You pointed to the work of a number of others, including Professor Denial, who's on the line with us. Let me just ask you why you wanted to make sure that there are other voices included.
Hi, Kate. I'm looking forward to seeing you in March at Geneseo and meeting you in person. I've been following Kate blogs matters of pedagogy quite a bit on her Twitter feed, and I've learned an immense amount from her and from people like Jesse Stommel and Kevin Gannon and others who write about this this process of grading.
Okay. And, you know, Kate, you, I think, go back just a few years in sort of refining your own approach. How far back does it go in terms of ungrading for you?
It's really only a couple of years for me. I went to the Digital Pedagogy Lab at the University of Mary Washington in Virginia in 2017. And that was where I got a whole host of new ideas about how to approach teaching and also how to approach grading.
So, Kate, if you could, why don't you define for me ungrading as a general term, because our listeners are going to hear that with some frequency this hour.
Absolutely. Ungrading is sort of an umbrella term. It pulls together any sort of collaborative feedback strategies that at some institutions replace grading altogether, and at some make for a better partnership between students and faculty members. So for me, it's about meeting with my students and giving them an opportunity to weigh in and tell me what they think their grade should be for a paper or an assignment or a project, whatever we're working on. Sometimes they're weighing in person. I like to have in-person meetings with all of my students. Sometimes they're weighing in writing. I like to have them do reflective essays, especially towards the end of the term.
Michael, for you, what I want to do first here is kind of walk through what you wrote about in your blog, and we're going to talk about why you did it. But tell me first what you did, what you changed.
Well, traditionally, I'd assign a couple of papers. I'd have students write journals over the course of the semester. They'd hand them in. I'd write comments, and I'd give them a score, a quantitative numerical score on qualitative work. I added up those points at the end of the semester, and that was traditionally the grade. I think that's the way a lot of us traditionally have done this. What I wanted to do was move away from sort of the tyranny of GPA and the tyranny of grades. So in what I've done instead is have the students submit their work. Instead of giving them a numerical score, I write extensive comments, criticism. I give them encouragement. I give them feedback. I give them points where they can improve. If I feel that they didn't work as well as they ought to have done, if they didn't proofread, if they were careless, I will explain why I felt that way, why it is important to put the effort into writing, and work with them to sort of set some standards for what a C, B, A, F, or a D looks like for the course, and have them allow them to sort of suggest what that is. And then at the end of the semester, I'd given them a couple of questions to think about, and I met with each one of them over the course of our finals week, and asked them, what do you think you deserve?
There's a lot of students, a lot of time.
It was, yeah, but I like our students, and it's nicer than spending this time just sitting, you know, waiting for exams to come in and things like that. So we talked, and you know, there were some students who, you know, a handful that had elevated notions of what they felt they deserved that I didn't think worked very well. But for the most part, they were accurate. The one thing I learned very clearly this past semester is that a relatively small number of non-traditional students, older students who are coming back to school, and a relatively small number of transfer students almost uniformly undervalued their effort and scored them much more harshly than I would ever have scored them. And I think that's because the community colleges, students coming from the community colleges or students re-entering college after a period of time, find themselves a bit overwhelmed at Geneseo, which does have very, very high academic standards. And that sense of feeling that they were a bit at sea caused them to think, well, I'm not doing very well. I'm so overwhelmed. I'm so lost. I'm chasing my tail. When in reality, they were doing quite well. So that was I think one of the important things that came out of this conversation. I learned a lot, and perhaps we can get to that as we're going on. But the things that really drove me to this is, really, just a year or two ago, my daughter was at an orientation at the college she was going to go to, and the speaker, who was a faculty member, and this is in the basketball arena, it's a big stadium, all the parents are there, goes, at this school, we don't give grades, students earn them. And everyone cheered, like this was the greatest line ever, and I thought, what an inane comment that is. Of course we give grades. You know, we're not Olympians dispensing wisdom. We measure, we assess, and we decide. And it just seemed to me that what we ought to have is some kind of system of looking at what students produce that is, that isn't just ranking them against each other, that isn't based on numbers, that evaluates and encourages improvement, a type of assessment that allows them to learn rather than just measures.
Particularly, as you write, because not all students come from the same background, starting from the same place. Fair?
Yeah, I think that's a huge problem, right? There are students who come into class knowing nothing and writing very poorly. They may have had poor preparation. They may not have taken high school seriously, right? And they come an immense amount of distance. They cover an immense amount of ground during the course of the semester. There are other students who come in who are so prepared for college. They know so much. They have so much cultural capital, right, at their disposal. They know the history. They write well. The first student I mentioned may work much harder, may have learned much more than the student who came in already prepared. It seems to me that if I just scored that student's papers in the old way, they might have ended up in a C+, B- range. I think learning is the important part of this. And look, one of the stories I told in that blog post is having lunch with an education professor many years ago, and he was talking about this student who was the best teacher he had ever seen, best student teacher he'd ever seen. And we're like, wow, this is great. We wonder who this guy is. And kind of we all looked at each other when we heard his name. He's sort of a C+, B- student by our standards. And, obviously he's taking what he hears in our classes and turning it into something incredible. That our grades that we were giving him in the history department didn't reflect what he was doing and what he was learning and what he was able to apply. And that sort of in a nutshell is part of the problem I have with grading.
Yeah, and so I can't wait to explore a lot of territory with both of our guests this hour about how the students react, because Kate has written about how students at first were kind of thinking, well, this is weird. You want to bring me into a conversation?
Yeah. Right.
You know, we're going to talk about that. We will talk about, listeners, you want to weigh in on maybe some of your questions about the grading process itself. But on that subject, Michael, the power dynamic is something I want to start with both you and Kate on. Here's what you write about the power dynamic. You write, I have always been uncomfortable at some level with the power relationship inherent in grading student work. Giving a bad grade closes doors on students and restricts opportunities available to them to pursue further studies, end quote. So what do you say to the critics who say, no, you are supposed to have the power in that classroom. That's your classroom. You're not an equal to the student. You know, they're not collaborators with you. They're there to learn from you. What do you say to those critics?
I say to those critics that I think just about, and the way you couched it in the introduction, just about everything they say I disagree with intensely. First of all, there's no diminishment of the standards here. The standards are extremely high, right? I'm making a case, and the students and I are talking about how we measure their achievement on that work. The standards are very high. The workload is very, very, very heavy. They do good work. The power dynamic, of course, that's there, right? And that doesn't go away, right? I've studied this stuff for longer than they've been alive. I've been teaching at Geneseo now that you mention it. Thanks. Longer than any of these students have been alive, right? So this is becoming a very disappointing conversation. But you know, so I know more than they can, but how do I get them there? I could do quizzes, make sure they read. I can do tests to measure what they've learned. They don't learn anything from those things, right? They don't get any. If I want to make sure you're reading, so I'm going to give you a quiz. That's coercive. That doesn't encourage learning.
That short-term regurgitation you don't think
it's
is
short-term
valuable.
Regurgitation. It's rote, it's unwilling, right? This Kate will be familiar with Roger Williams, right? The Puritan minister, and he had this thing like, you can't force people who don't want to go to church, right? Forced worship stinketh in God's nostrils. That was Roger Williams' line, right? And forcing these kind of coercive teaching methods, I just don't think work with students these days. So I will make a case as to why they need to do this work, why this is important, and I will help guide them there. And I think it's more effective for me to use my expertise, my experience, my authority to guide them to learn things rather than to tell them what they need to learn.
Okay, and one other question for you before I turn to Kate on this subject. When you write that giving bad grades closes doors on students and restricts opportunities available to them to pursue further studies, I'm reminded of the story you shared from your daughter's initiation where they're talking, you know, the professor says, you know, students earn these grades. Yeah. And that professor might say, well, if a student gets a bad grade, they have earned a bad grade. What's the problem you have with that?
There's a lot of problems I have with that. Look, every once in a while I will hear someone say that I'll give you two examples. I'll hear someone say that the students we're letting into our college aren't prepared. They don't know how to read like students used to be, blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah. Right? They're not as well prepared. Well, I think anyone who's listening who teaches in the public school system, right, elementary school or secondary school, would say, tough, you got to go teach them. You have to get them up to your standard. You can't just say, oh, well, they're not any good. You get a C-, right? You have to go where they are. You have to get students up to that level. You have to do the work. Grading, in that sense, can be sort of a throwaway for doing your own work. Second of all, I think, well, I'll give you a second example. I had a colleague who would require her students to write 10 or 11 essays over the course of the semester, short little essays, right? If you missed one of those essays, you flunked the course. So you could get A++ on 10 of those essays, 9 of those essays. And let's say you break up with a girlfriend or something happens.
Something traumatic, yeah.
Something happens. You don't get it in. You flunk the course. Well, how is that grade reflective of that student's obvious capacity to do good work? And then, of course, you know, so many fields now students need to pursue graduate training, right? The bachelor's degree is not the end of their education. They need to move forward. With the case of the student I mentioned earlier, right, who we sort of had pegged as a C+ B- student, he may have wanted he needed to go on and get a master's degree in education. He may want to pursue education administration, all kinds of fields. Our grades C+ could have closed the door to some of those opportunities. At the same time that grade had no bearing to what that student was actually taking from our classes and able to apply.
Wow. Kate, what was the reaction of students? And I hope you can be, you know, detailed for our listeners, because I enjoyed reading about it on your website. When you described their initial thought was, I'm going to sit down with you and talk about my grade before you assign it. That's weird.
Yes. they're used to a system in which they're awarded grades by someone in a position of power. And so to come into my office and to sit down with me and for me to ask them, what grade do you think you earned? That's really discombobulating for a lot of students. Now several of my students are used to it and are more comfortable with it. But that first time is a real shifting in the way that they think about their education. And so part of what we do is spend some time talking about why I'm asking them to have a say in what their grade is.
Okay. And when it comes to that collaboration, what do you say to the critics, Kate, who think, well, you ought not just be asking students for their thoughts on this? Because I think they think two things. I think they think there would be an epidemic of students overinflating their own performance, which you and Michael, and frankly, every professor I've read, whether it's Professor Stommel or others who've written about ungrading, have said that the vast majority do not overinflate.
Exactly.
They're pretty accurate, and there is a subpopulation that will under assess.
Yeah.
Though I'm sure there are some cases, and Michael wrote a little bit about the student who kind of overinflated. We'll talk about that in a moment. But I think the critics also think, well, that's not their job anyway. That's your job to assess. What do you say to that?
I think that one of the things I'm looking to do as an educator is teach my students how to be able to assess how they're doing. That's part of their learning cycle, is to then be able to assess that and think for themselves about what they need to do to improve and how they want to get to whatever their goal is for that class. So I think it's very much something that should be part of their education so that they can become more self-driven, self-motivated. They can set their own goals and reach them.
I think, Kate and Professor Ober, I wonder if both of you feel, as you have amended the way that you assess students, if the students themselves, their own expectation for how college professors will grade them, is a product of a K-12 system that puts all of this emphasis on standardized tests, of rote memorization, of preparing for the test, taking the test, and then moving on with life. You know, so you sort of like, you kind of walk away from it, you're done, you're on to the next subject. Professor Denial, do you find that students have to adjust to the notion of ungrading or a new process because, generally speaking, our K-12 is the way it is?
I think so. And again, I would say it's generally speaking. There are obviously exceptions to that rule. And we get lots of students who have had amazing high school instructors who've taught them how to wrestle with primary sources and to really think for themselves. But there is this overarching system that seeks to quantify what students are doing with decimal points, you know, to be able to say this is your GPA or this is the score that you got on your SATs. So yes, students are very used to that system. And I think that students are limited by that system because that system is rewarding correct, in quote marks, answers. Whereas what we're trying to do is open up a world of learning to them where the questions are more important than the answers are.
Professor Oberg, how do you feel about what K-12 is preparing students and their expectations?
Yeah, I think I agree with everything Kate said. I had a couple of students, and as I watch my own kids go through high school, they can check the online system at the high school, and they know what every assignment is, and I'm given access to it. And it's like, I don't care. I don't want to check every assignment. But it's all very specific, and it's down to, well, you've got a 92.75 right now going into the final week of the quarter at the high school. Some students were particularly the freshmen, were unnerved by that. They needed to know where they were precisely at a point in time, and I you know, it didn't take long for them to adjust to it. And at a point in the semester, just about halfway through, I said, how do you like this? How is this working for you? And we had a great, 40-minute discussion about this in the class. And the general view is that it reduced stress on the students' part and put them in a place where they could kind of focus on just learning, doing the work and learning. They weren't worried about the score, right? They're playing for fun, in a sense.
Well, listeners, I want to hear from you this hour, and I already have some questions and comments, and we're going to hit those in just a moment, especially in our second half hour, as we talk about changing the way we grade, particularly a trend toward ungrading. And an old colleague of mine writes to us on Twitter and says that West Virginia University is publishing a book on ungrading. Kate, you want to fill us in on that? You jumped right on that. So there's a book on ungrading forthcoming, yes?
Forthcoming from West Virginia University Press, which is an incredible press for thinking about cutting-edge pedagogy and thinking about creative ways to teach. So that's forthcoming in 2020. And Jesse Stummel, who we've all sort of talked about a little bit here, is one of the people who has an essay in that book.
Okay. And so there is more conversation about this process of collaborative assessment, of not just sort of adhering to sort of a dry rubric and just sticking students into that matrix and then sending them on with their life, but really assessing not what did you earn, but what have you been taught, and how far have you come, and how are you adapting to the skills and knowledge you brought in versus where you are now. Listen, if you want to weigh in, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Bob wants to know, he said, let me pull his email back up. Bob said, it's nice to have compassion for students who are struggling, but you ultimately have to offer them a grade. They cannot be giving their own grades to themselves. So let me be more specific, if I haven't enough. At least my understanding is, it's not that Professor Oberg and Professor Denial and other professors who are engaging in ungrading are saying to students, all right, you pick your grade.
Right.
It's a collaborative process that yields interesting conversations. And let me read a little bit from Professor Oberg's blog again, because, again, the point being, the vast majority of the time, the students are either assessing themselves fairly or even under-assessing their performance. On the occasions where students might try to game it or convince the professor, no, I'm an A student, when they didn't even show up, here's what Professor Oberg wrote. A small number of students wildly overstated, in my view, the quality of their performance in the class. A student who came to a third of our class meetings, did not participate in our discussions, and who watched videos on his laptop, thought he deserved a B when I thought he was failing the course. What to do then? I pointed out why I thought his estimation was too high. Sometimes, I must remind myself, a student and I might not agree. We talked about what he had learned, and it was then that he persuaded me that he took from my class more than his work and his engagement showed. I gave him a D, but I felt terrible about it. Professor Oberg, elaborate a little bit on that one, because again, so the listeners who are probably more prone to be critics of this system are going to assume that this is more common, that there's a lot of students saying, no, I'm an A student, or I'm a B student, even though I barely showed up. That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, I raised more grades by far. I mean, I had students say, I think I deserve a B minus. It's like, no. Here's what you did. You participated in every discussion. You're an A student. There was far more of that where I had a much higher view of their work
than they did.
Yeah, and in this particular case, this was a hard one, because this was a student who wasn't tuned in, he wasn't engaged, and what do I do in that case? He was apparently he'd done the reading. He seemed to have done the reading, and so I think and this is where I follow Kate's lead. And I'm going to adopt some of the things she does in her class, with really devoting much more time at the beginning of the semester to working collaboratively with the students on a set of standards for what I think the grades look like. And it'll be like James Madison in Philadelphia, right? I'll come in with the draft, and then we can talk from my draft. But this is not This I disagree intensely with anyone who suggests that this is coddling students. They're doing the same hard work that they've always done.
Okay, and let me ask both you, Michael, and then Kate on this. What's the value to you to being able to sit down with a student who assumes maybe I'm a B-minus, C-plus student, and you think they're an A student? They could just get that grade sort of in the mail and be surprised and happily move on with their life. But when you can sit down for 15 minutes and tell them, you're under-assessing yourself, and I want to tell you why. What's the value in you to be able to do that?
Well, there's a lot of kind of qualitative measures. But one, I learn in ways that I didn't learn before what works in my class, what doesn't work in my class, what I'm effectively communicating to students, what I am failing to communicate effectively to students. Second, it's just this, the pleasure that comes from seeing students buy into a process and assert some ownership over the process of learning that I think is empowering. You know, some of these students, here's the thing with teaching, and I think this is probably true with all teachers, right? I can have a bad morning and say something unthinkingly critical and ruin a student's academic life, right? Cause them to change their major, cause them to hate a subject. I can say something positive and affirmative and open up door after door, brand new horizons. And this system of grading gives me the opportunity always to do the latter.
Professor Denow?
I think one of the most impressive things about doing grading this way is that it changes the way that students approach grades. So traditionally, I think students think that everyone's going to get an A, and it's a system of demerits. So how did you screw up? What did you get wrong? And what I'm trying to do is say, no, what did you do right? Here are the things you're really good at. Here's where we can strengthen your work even further. And the thing that really matters when they're sitting in my office and talking to me is they believe me. I'm making eye contact with them. I'm talking about it with them. And so they know that I'm not just giving them a platitude before I tell them all the things they did wrong. Instead, I'm actually saying, you are seriously good at doing these things. And that makes a huge difference to the way that they think about grading, but also just the way they think about themselves as scholars.
I want to work in more of your feedback because we've got a wide range of views on the idea of ungrading. So if you're on the phone, Mike, Bernard, we'll get to you. We've got some comments that have come in via other platforms. We're talking about ungrading, and the piece that sparked our attention came from Michael Leroy Oberg, a distinguished professor of history at SUNY Geneseo. We will link to that if you want to check out what he's written. And you ought to look up the work from Professor Kate Denial, who is on the line with us, a professor of American history and chair of the Department of History at Knox College in Illinois. They are making the case not for coddling students, as they have said, but for working collaboratively with them and to view grading in a different manner and to really think about teaching, not just grading students, but teaching students. Let's get that break, and your feedback is next. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with the superintendent of the Brockport Central School District, a woman who's heading for a new job. Dr. Leslie Myers-Small has been the leader at Brockport for much of this past decade, and she is heading to the State Department of Education. The Board of Regents has named her Assistant Commissioner for the Office of Innovation, and her focus will be on school districts that are struggling, like Rochester. So how will she help? She'll tell us next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let's get some of your feedback. Mike from Irondequoit first. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, good morning. A couple questions that I'd be interested in feedback from your panelists here. First off is, in relation to, like, you know, history or biology, there's a certain body of knowledge that the comprehension of is, like, non-negotiable. Like, George Washington was the first president. You know, it's like if someone is making a mistake on specific pieces of information, I mean, how would you incorporate, you know, the non-negotiables in this process? That's one question. The other question is, doesn't this process, it's wonderful. I agree with it, but it's very time intensive. Mm-hmm. And in reality, wouldn't this process required feedback throughout the course, not just at the end. So students can gauge whether they are making the progress and whether they truly are learning.
Yeah, Mike.
That falls right into your question about K through 12.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in a K through 12 environment, it's much different than the collegiate environment, and the amount of time required to touch base with 100 students, not one time in a semester, but, you know,
sure,
on a regular ongoing basis.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just say before I kick it to our guests on that, Kate has been, Professor Denial has already addressed this, and I think, among others, that there are certain settings where it may not be possible. If you've got 200 or 300 students in a class, you may not be able to invest the time to do this way, or you may have to sort of modify it. To your point there, I mean, I think that's just... that's absolutely on the money, and I'll let our guests respond to whether they think there are times where ungrading just isn't sort of feasible on just the scale of it, let alone the non-negotiables, as you talk about. But I think, Professor Oberg, it should be noted as well, I think you mentioned in your blog post that you're not just sitting down to talk grades at the end of a semester. Instead of scoring a paper, you're offering extensive feedback without just slapping a 94 or an 82 or whatever on it. Yes? Is that right?
That's correct. I think, about the feedback, I think that's a good question. I'm writing much more extensive comments. I find my office hours are much more crowded than they were in the past. The students kind of come in and they may not know how to make the improvements I'm proposing in their writing, or they may not know what a passive verb is, right? So we spend a lot more time sitting down and talking it through. I talk about it in class time, about what papers did well, what papers, you know, generally speaking, what they did well, where they need to improve. So the feedback is offered consistently throughout the semester with every assignment the students turn in. It's at the final meeting where the students are sort of using the standards we've agreed upon, setting a grade for themselves. So I think that's where it works. But of course, yeah, I think there are fields. The caller mentioned medicine, but you know, I'm a historian, right? So I don't know these other fields. But there are things where there are, you need to know an equation, you need to know a theorem, you need to know the molecular weight of some compound, right? Those are facts that this sort of learning may not work as well for. For history, I think it works better. I don't feel it's significantly more time consuming than the way I've taught in the past. Or if it is more time consuming, it's rewarding enough that the benefit is worth the cost.
Yeah, but you know, someday on a separate program, we ought to come and talk about the idea, because I think Mike brought up in really good faith, and I think his call was made in good faith, but when he says, you know, certain things are non-negotiable, George Washington was the first president, et cetera, again, I think he means well, but he's reflecting a view that history is just a regurgitation of historical data and facts, as opposed to understanding that history is written by the winners. And looking at history through different lenses is probably really valuable and probably deserves its own separate conversation. Do you want to come back sometime?
Yeah, every once in a while you'll see someone will circulate some questionnaire, like the students are asked certain things, you know, facts about American history, and they tend to perform poorly, right? You had a show on the citizenship exam a while back. People perform poorly. Well, none of us would disagree with the premise that you ought to know certain basic things about American history. It's just how you get students there to do it. Quizzes and rote memorization don't work, right? I can tell you I don't think I can remember a single thing I learned in high school history.
Don't quiz me either.
It's how you get there.
I'm ready to be embarrassed if you do that. No, I think that's great. And Professor Denial, let me read a tweet that sort of dovetails with what Mike says a little bit here. Tom says, I really hope this ungrading nonsense does not drift into fields like medicine, math, and science, where competence really matters. What Tom is really saying is a stronger, more sort of strident version of the concern that there are certain non-negotiables, and you can't just sit down and negotiate with students over their grade. They either learned it or they didn't. What do you say to that, Professor?
I think that's that's a misunderstanding about what exactly we do in history classes or other humanities and social science classes. There are, of course, pieces of basic knowledge that you need to go under to be able to do higher level analysis. And so, yes, it matters that you know that George Washington is the first president, for example. But that knowledge needs to then be applied. And that's what we're grading when we're talking about papers or projects or assignments of any kind. We're saying, can you take those facts and can you apply them in a way that makes them useful to you? How can you take a burning question from today's society and explain to me the history that led us to this moment? How can you analyze some primary sources, things that were left to us from the era that we're studying, and make sense of them and not simply accept what somebody wrote or somebody said, but actually think through the layers of perspective that are involved in understanding a document like that. So I think that it's not just about spitting back facts. I actually am a new citizen. I just took the citizenship test not that long ago. And that really is an exercise in spitting back facts. A great example is that they ask, what happened at the Constitutional Convention? As a historian, I sort of reared back in my seat and went, oh my goodness, which thing did they want me to talk about? The answer they wanted was the Constitution was written. So that's some very basic knowledge that they wanted, and that's fine for that sort of thing. But what we're doing is we're taking that and we're applying it.
Okay. Let me get Bernard on the phone, but first Tony in Rochester next. Go ahead, Tony. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Yeah. Don't you believe that you're setting these kids up for failure? Now, I have a student who's in, my son goes to the Wilson IB program, and he is expected to do what he is told to do. They give him assignments, and he is expected to turn those assignments in. He doesn't get a pass if he doesn't do it. And that is, in general, what life is. When these people go and they become employed, an employer is going to require him to do a job. They're not going to let him not do the job and still be employed. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do, very much so. I think that we're, again, talking about slightly different things. First of all, I would say that our students very much exist in the quote-unquote real world. They're dealing with real-world issues all the time. So I don't think there's quite such a divide between college and what comes after college as people sometimes think. I also think that students are very capable of following direction. I think by the time they get to college, they've been trained in that exceptionally well. And what we're trying to do is get them to be critical thinkers, people who can think on their own, as well as be able to follow the directions. And so I think it's a combination of those skills. And when they come to us, they have one set of skills developed very well, and they need help developing a different set of skills.
Right. But if they can't develop them skills or aren't capable of developing them skills, should they not be allowed to attend college? It's like you're making excuses for these kids. And these kids are starting to realize in life that there is no consequences for your actions anymore, that somebody will come along with a piece of toilet paper and clean up behind you. And that is not the way you bring kids up these days.
I think that if you take a look at, for example, my blog, where I talk about what I do when I do this kind of grading, you'll see that I have some very explicit guidelines for what constitutes every single grade. So it's not a matter of making excuses and saying anything goes. It's instead a process where you sit down with the students and say, does this seem fair? Do you have questions? What kind of edits can we make so that this speaks to your experience? And then we hold them to those standards. So they are not getting out of anything. There's no less rigor than there used to be, but we're thinking of this as partnership rather than simply a top-down set of instructions.
Professor Ober?
Yeah, I think Tony was criticizing us for an argument we didn't raise, right? The students are held to very high standards. They have to do good work, and they're all kinds of different ways to do that work. We do different things. My colleague Yvonne Seal does She kind of un-essays, right? And rather than term papers, I think Professor Denial does that as well, right?
Yeah.
Where an alternative to the conventional term paper. But students in the history major still learn the skills of the discipline, even if they do something else in this field. The standards are high. They are expected to do the work that we agree collaboratively that they will do. And there are consequences in terms of a poor final grade at the end if they don't live up to the standards that they helped contribute to making. So, again, I think that there's this notion, and I think it's perpetuated in parts of the media, that colleges baby college students, and that college students aren't equipped to deal with the real world. And like Professor Denial mentioned, they are in the real world. These students put up, they have enormously complicated things going on in their lives. They overcome incredible obstacles. And I would argue with Tony or anyone else that this generation of young people that I'm fortunate to teach, they are so much better than my generation, born in the 60s, who have had plenty of opportunities to make the world a better place. And if frankly fumbled in quite a way. These students are open-minded, they are creative, they are hardworking, they are determined to apply what they are learning into classroom to making this world a better place.
Now, let's put something to rest here. Will you still fail students, Michael?
I didn't this semester.
Okay. Will you in the future, if they earn? We're in precarious language here, but
it is possible for a student to fail a class based on the standards that we agree upon as a class.
Okay.
Absolutely,
Professor Denial.
Yes, absolutely. A student can fail.
Tony, thank you for the phone call. And just on that note of not sort of babying students, the one thing that comes to mind for me, having had the grand total massive sample size experience of teaching one adjunct course in my life, is a little bit of the concern that that college or university work can be, I think people would call it transactional. The idea being, well, we're paying you a lot of money, you better give me something for it, and the pressure then to make sure that the students are satisfied, and so that you are still an attractive place to come. That because higher ed can be expensive, but students will, and families in the future will know it's expensive, but we'll get something for it. As opposed to, you might get failed. And I didn't have students in my one small course telling me, well, I paid for this, you can't give me this grade. But I have heard others express concern that there is an expectation that there is something transactional here. So it's less about coddling and more about treating it like a business transaction, that I gave you the money, you better give me something I can work with and use here. Professor Oberg, I'll start with you. What do you make of that?
This is my 26th year of teaching. I've never had a student say anything like that to me in my life. But here's where I do think there's a quality to this. The college is expensive. It's an enormous hardship for many families to get their children to college. It's many hardship for many students to pay for college. And when a faculty member says, oh, well, this student's work is poor, or this student doesn't measure up to my standard for X grade, or these students these days, right, you hear this all the time, they don't read, or they have no attention span, or whatever the case may be, there is a responsibility on me as an instructor to go to where those students are and teach them, right? That if we admit them to our college, that comes with an obligation to instruct them. We can't just say they're not good enough and flunk them out. We have to go to where they are and raise them up to our standards.
Okay, Professor Denial.
I don't think the transactional model of education works at all. I've had one student in 25 years who's suggested something like that to me. And in a conversation with them, we came to a conclusion that that wasn't actually what they wanted. That sometimes students have a little trouble explaining the ineffable part of what they're getting out of college, that it is these critical thinking skills. It's the ability to look at a web page and analyze it and understand whether they're being fed lies or not. It's the ability to pick up any book and assess it for themselves. Those kinds of things are not so quantitative. They are skills that are so important to us living, robust lives as involved people in our communities. those are not things that you can really say, here's $10, I would like X something back. It's much more intangible than that.
I'm drowning in listener feedback on this, so let's keep it rolling. Bernard in Fairport next. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yes, I think it's a problem to just declare how somebody is smart by putting A, B, C, or D on them. I went to the U of R for 5 years, and I made well below C. But over the last 30 years, I've made a lot more money than professors and worked around the world doing things. And I think the reason that I did was because I was interested in what was going on, what I needed to learn, and I wasn't interested in making somebody give me an A. So it wasn't important in my mind to get an A. Now, obviously, I'm wrong because a lot of people get judged by how their grade is. But I just have this problem that it doesn't necessarily explain how smart or good a student is. And that's just my concern about the whole thing.
Yeah. Bernard, okay? Bernard, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And let me read an email that sort of is on the same thread before I send it over to our guest to comment on that. Because what Bernard's essentially saying is he took a lot from college, even if it wasn't the letter grades that society says will determine whether he's smart or learned, et cetera. Well, writing to us from Vancouver, Canada, here's Dave, who says, I taught as a faculty member very much focused on research. I taught only graduate students and gave occasional lectures to medical students. I had to grade my sections on med students' exams, but I did not use any formal examinations or tests in my grad school courses. My main goal was to ensure that the students had the necessary knowledge base and could think well, using the basics of that knowledge to analyze evidence, construct hypotheses, propose, and when they were in my lab, conduct experimental approaches to further our knowledge and especially understanding. I've never liked grades. Obviously, ensuring the fundamental knowledge necessary to function is very important, but critical thinking skills are by far more important in my view. That's from Dave. So there's Bernard and Dave. Professor Oberg, what do you think?
I love that email because one of the things I've heard from people is, well, this won't work for the sciences, and it sounds like Dave has figured out a way to do that. And I think certainly at a liberal arts college like Geneseo, we emphasize that very much, the critical thinking skills, the value of these skills. Jesse Stommel wrote some wonderful stuff on his blog, how he wants his heart surgeon to be able to have read the great works of literature, to have this compassion and this breadth of knowledge and this wisdom that comes with engaging this sort of thought, and the problem-solving skills that come and the critical thinking skills. So I think that's a wonderful way of putting it.
Okay, Professor Denial?
I think that something that's really interesting to consider is that pedagogy has changed an enormous amount in the last 30 years. And so we are thinking more expansively about what it takes to assess someone and to sort of say, yes, this person is a great critical thinker. This person is really engaged with the world. That ties back to something called universal design, where we sort of take as our starting point the idea that everybody coming into our classroom is unique and that there are going to be multiple different ways of thinking in that classroom. And then we teach to that. And this goes back to what Michael was saying earlier about, like, we start where our students are and we think creatively about all the ways to get them to show us what they are learning as they are learning it. That metacognition part of things is so, so important for them to understand why there's value in what they're doing.
Professor Denial, can this kind of a model of ungrading move to the K-12 level?
I think that depends on a lot of different factors. So, for instance, the school systems I'm used to in Iowa and Illinois are quite different from yours in New York State. But I think that there's moments where this is definitely something doable. And in fact, the teachers I've worked with most closely in Iowa, where I was part of a project that worked with 900 different teachers, they are doing this kind of work and giving feedback to their students in order for them to be able to do more and think more creatively. So I don't think it's a huge leap from where so many teachers are. It's just removing that quantitative piece of it and saying that that thing that you know about your student doesn't add up to 3.5 or 4.2 sure. or whatever you want to say.
Professor Oberg?
Yeah, I think the teachers I see as a parent, right, are many of them are doing this already. And I think it works wonderfully well. They are, and I don't know if New York is worse than other states in this regard, but they are beholden to a testing regime and standardized assessments of student work that they have to pay attention to for their job security. But however that affects teachers, I see some of the great teachers my students have worked with doing this already, and at the elementary school level and in the high schools.
In 30 seconds, Michael, do you have other colleagues at Geneseo just on your own campus asking, talking more about this? Do you think you'll see more of this?
I've been contacted by a couple people on campus just since this blog post appeared, and I'm following some of my fine colleagues who are doing this work as well.
So, Kate, do you think that we're going to see, especially with the publication of the book from WVU Press, but in other settings, do you think we'll see more conversation about grading and assessing this way?
I really do. And the book is called Ungrading, Rewarded by Learning. It's edited by Susan Bloom. And I really think we're going to see much more of this as we move forward.
My gosh. Anne just sent this wonderful long email that I didn't have time to read. I've got a pile. My inbox is full. We could have just done another hour of feedback from listeners praising, concerns, clarifications, but continue the conversation in various places. We'll post Professor Oberg's blog post on this, and you can find Professor Catherine Denial's work on this as well. Kate, thanks for taking the time. We really appreciated the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Kate is a professor of American history and chair of the Department of History at Knox College in Illinois. She's going to be at Geneseo in March. Professor Oberg, yes?
She will, and I can't remember the exact date. The Friday before our spring break, so for our annual Teacher's Day.
You'll hear Professor Oberg back here. We'll bring you back talking history and more. More connections coming up.